These proceedings are appeal in the case entitled J.K. Harris and Company against Ronald Sandlin, an appeal from the Superior Court of Marion County. The court recognized for the appellant, Mr. Miller, welcome. You've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct, sir?
Yes.
And Mr. Kite and Mr. Is it Weaver?
Words, Your Honor.
Okay. And are you ready to proceed, gentlemen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Miller.
My name is Gary Miller. I represent J.K. Harris and Company, LLC, an Indiana foreign limited liability company. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, members of the court, we are here today to talk about a written contract between Ronald Sandlin and J.K. Harris for professional services provided by J.K. Harris in assisting Mr. Sandlin with federal and state tax problems, which was entered into on February 24th, 2006. With all due respect to Mr. Sandlin, I will probably end up just using the word Sandlin, and I don't mean any disrespect by that during the course of the argument. Mr. Sandlin was not satisfied with the services that J.K. Harris provided, and he filed a complaint in the Marion Superior Court, Civil Division Room 6, against J.K. Harris for negligence and breach of fiduciary duty as individual claims, and statutory deception and unjust enrichment as class claims. J.K. Harris did not answer the complaint, and a default judgment was granted to Sandlin on the individual claims and granting class action certification.
And am I correct? You really don't dispute service.
We do not dispute that service was made upon the resident agent for J.K. Harris.
And isn't that adequate under Indiana law?
Absolutely.
So I understand the brunt of your argument to be that, but there's this arbitration agreement, and that's what we really should be doing. But why aren't they obligated to present that to a court and let a court order it to arbitration?
Well, that goes to our first argument regarding the trial court's jurisdiction over this case. Now, we're not talking about jurisdiction over anything else but this specific case.
Trial court has jurisdiction over anything and everything unless you complain to the contrary, right?
True. However, in this case, we have a very interesting situation that's occurred. The plaintiff, Mr. Sandlin, asked for the default. The default was granted. What does default mean? It means under Indiana law that the complaint is confessed. In the complaint, there was a provision that says very specifically that contained within this complaint is a true and accurate copy of the agreement between Sandlin and J.K. Harris. It's attached hereto and incorporated herein by reference and identified as Exhibit B.
Most judgments, I think I'm correct in this, that are civil in nature are in Indiana default judgments.
Possibly, yes. Well, yes, considering mortgage foreclosure and
just all kinds
collection
of
matters, yes.
Okay. So you're not going to suggest to me that it's the responsibility of a trial judge, position that we both occupied, I think, that I'm supposed to, on a presentation of a motion to default judgment, I'm going to say, oh, give me that document here. Let me go read those 37 pages.
Well, I hope you're not suggesting the trial court has no obligation to read the contract.
I don't know that it does unless you say that there's an issue that it should.
Under the adversarial system.
Right.
Well, in this particular case, what has happened is, and the law in the state of Indiana is very clear, the terms of a contract are contained within the four corners of the document. Second clear principle under Indiana law is a party who wishes to avoid the terms in a contract is obligated to raise that, to challenge those terms.
But I guess, Mr. Miller, with all due respect, a precursor or precondition to all that is that anyone who receives a summons and a complaint in a court in Indiana is expected to respond in that court.
I concur. Absolutely.
It's the same principle that we have on appeal. That is, if one party appears and the other doesn't, we follow the prima facie rule. And we're, because we're not responsible as appellate judges for carrying the water, the legal water, of the party who doesn't reply. Aren't you really asking for the trial court to carry the water for your client in scrutinizing the contract and fashioning a judgment in order to represent your client's position?
Well, what we're asking is that the court, when it enters into default, follow the terms of the contract. Not change the terms of the contract, not alter them, not add to them.
Well, what the court does, what the court does is in the case of a default judgment, is grant the relief requested. And the relief requested was not arbitration. It was other relief that would normally be granted in a civil action, was it not?
That's true, but in the terms of the contract, the very specific terms of the contract, which we submitted to the court, the trial court, at that late February hearing date,
right,
which was a legible copy of the contract, you can clearly see that the three provisions that we are arguing are in bold typeface. They are well set out within the contract, and it is the obligation of a party who seeks to avoid the terms of the contract to raise that as an issue. It would have been very simple for Sandlin and counsel to have said, there are provisions in this contract, including binding arbitration, limitation of damages, and failure to participate in class action lawsuits. But the trial court should waive that because they've waived it by defaulting.
In other words, set up the straw man for the party who fails to appear, answer, or otherwise plead, knock it down, and then have a court enter a judgment that addresses the arbitration issue?
Absolutely. They have to address the issue. Let's take a very extreme example. Let's say J.K. Harris got service, and I'm not saying that this is true. Let's say J.K. Harris got service, and they said, you know, we know what's in our contract. We know that under these provisions, they're limited on the amount of damages. They can't participate in class action certification. And they certainly can't deal with the other issues that we've been raised. So
maybe
the trial court can't do what the trial court...
That's probably... It appears to me that that's exactly what happened here, is that they just looked at their own contract and said, we have nothing to fear because under this contract, we're entitled to arbitration. But when they were served with the summons, they were required to appear and answer and assert that as in the nature of an affirmative defense.
I disagree. I don't think those are affirmative defenses. The contract itself stands for itself.
To take your argument to the logical conclusion, notwithstanding the fact that we have a trial rule, and I can't remember its number, I think 9, that says that if you have a special defense, you have to raise it.
8C.
Well, there you go. Pretty good. If we have, but you're saying when there's a default, it doesn't matter.
Well, one of the things that we certainly understand, Judge, is the way to attack the entry of a default judgment is by filing a trial rule 60 motion.
Right.
We did that. We think this is separate and apart from that.
Okay.
Issue,
let's go back
but
to
we
the,
think it folds back in to the okay, B8 let, argument.
Okay. Let's talk about courts generally don't like default judgments. We've said that a
many
lot
times
today, and many times in the past. Having said that, there are a need in our court system for finality, and if a person wants to challenge the validity of a judgment, there's a requirement that they have to meet. Tell me why you believe that Judge Carroll erred in denying your 60 motion?
Well, he, in the colloquy in denying it, said that there were service issues. He did not address the standard that the trial court is to impose. We gave him a number of reasons under 60B8, if he chose not to accept the 60B1 argument, that justice in this case...
60B1 is...
Mistake, surprise, or excusable neglect.
OK. Okay. What was the mistake?
Well, there was no mistake. We're talking about excusable neglect.
Okay. What was the excusable neglect?
We allege that it's the lack of service by the trial court of notice of hearings in the case.
Okay. That really intrigues me because I've often thought about that. Do you have authority to support that if service is not obtained on the defendant, that the defendant who has not come under the personal jurisdiction of the court, if service is obtained and the defendant fails to appear, answer, or otherwise plead, that the court is to send out CCS and other entries to the address stated on the summons anyway?
I don't have the authority at my fingertips. I can certainly get that or try to find that for you. But in every court that I've ever been to in my 30-year career, the CCS entry, as long as the CCS has been around, will show court sends notice, notice sent. And in fact, in this case, when you look at the CCS, you not only see where that's lacking in the setting of all of these hearings, but you see when I entered my appearance and in one instance when the court set a hearing, the court did send notice to counsel of record.
How do you square that with the language of Trial Rule 5A, which says no service need be made on parties in default for failure to appear? In other words, once you've been defaulted, once there was service on the Secretary of State, unless you come in and provide some sort of notice of a new address or that you're actually in existence and ought to be, you know, ought to be considered for future hearings, court has no obligation.
Well, I think that's not true. That shouldn't be true. Principles of fundamental fairness and due process would indicate, particularly when we're talking about taking a class action matter, that notice.
I agree that the class action, we might have to bifurcate a little bit here.
We definitely do.
With regard to the class action issues. But I just really have to share with you, I have a problem with a party, your client, who didn't care to show up and show his affirmative defense of arbitration, which would immediately cause Judge Carroll to say, oh, hey, arbitration clause, go pick your arbitrators.
Arbitration is not an affirmative defense. I don't think that,
I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to clarify something. I really do like to understand this. I'm looking at your first pleading, Mr. Miller. Paragraph 5, you state, J.K. Harris is challenging the subject matter jurisdiction of the court by filing its motion to set aside default judgment. Is that still your position today?
No, Your Honor. We are challenging the jurisdiction of the case.
The case, okay.
Which is different, and of course, the case law sort of muddies these concepts.
Sometimes they're easy to confuse, but yes. Clearly this court has jurisdiction over this case absent an arbitration agreement.
Yes.
And jurisdiction to determine whether or not the arbitration agreement applies.
Yes.
Okay.
Once the contract is confessed, isn't the plaintiff bound by the terms of that contract, and isn't the court bound by the terms of that contract?
Time out. Just to so help me get up to speed with everybody else here. The original complaint made a claim for relief on behalf of Mr. Sandlin, is that correct? Did it say anything about class action?
Yes.
Okay. So, under the law, your client is on notice that all of those claims that were eventually defaulted were before the trial court, so that the exception to Rule 5, which says you do have to send notice even to a defaulted party if something new or if the pleadings assert a new or additional claim for relief. So all of the claims for relief were made
in the original complaint.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And I will qualify that by saying that part of our argument is that on default, the court accepts as confessed the complaint, but does not accept as confessed any other pleadings that are filed afterwards. And part of our complaint part of our issue with the class action certification is that there were subsequent pleadings filed, and all of the pleadings and the complaint together don't form the substance and
you cause. You seem willing to concur with my assertion that most judgments in civil cases in Indiana are probably default judgments of a collection nature. Many of those collection cases involve an assertion for principal, accrued interest, and attorney's fees. You and I know well and good that a defaulted party is sometimes there's been a default entered, and then the plaintiff makes the motion for a final judgment and submits an affidavit asserting from the banker that there's still $24,000 due and that the accrued interest calculated to date is $1,028 and the attorney's fees are $3,500. All of that assertion having been made without notice to the defaulted party under Rule 5A. There has been
standard practice.
Right. And it's in a standard practice pursuant. Is there anything that was done in this case
that was different?
That was different than what happens in courthouses all over Indiana?
Yes, the trial court abused its discretion once there was an entry of an appearance by counsel to challenge that. The court abused its discretion in failing to set it aside. The vast majority of judges would have, I shouldn't say this, I would guess, was my practice, as you indicated since I was on the bench, you grant liberal defaults and you enter liberal set-asides when there is a good and just reason to do that.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there's nothing I'm going to just say personally, I distaste more than a default judgment. But the rules say you have to tell me what's wrong with the default judgment. That is, that there was problems with service, that there was a gross injustice.
Mistake, surprise, or excusable neglect.
I need to know what the excuse, you say there's no mistake or surprise, but what the excusable neglect is on the part of J.K. Harris.
That really is the first question. What is the excusable neglect under Rule 60B1?
I believe it's the lack of notice of the proceedings, the subsequent proceedings after the default.
But you would agree with me, you probably don't want to, you would agree with me that at least on first glance, Rule 5.5A seems to say that wasn't required.
Yes.
Okay.
And but if I understand what you're saying, Mr. Miller, correctly, you would agree that the underlying judgment has been essentially confessed, that given the fact that we have a prayer for damages and no one shows up and an affidavit for damages, that the damages are within the scope of what a reasonable judge would do.
No, the issue of damages has not been concluded yet. That issue has not been determined.
This is interlocutory.
It's an interlocutory appeal on the issue of class action certification and the jurisdictional issue. Again, most of our argument regarding 60B8 deals with the equities in this case, and we can get to that in a few moments. I do want to say this about, and I suppose we can talk about class action since we want to.
Yeah, you said that it's supposed to be different, or somebody did.
I think I said we should probably bifurcate.
Okay.
I think Judge Mathias said that.
Okay.
Someone said.
Okay.
Someone said. In any event,
we're going to bifurcate it. Even on default, the court has to analyze the issues on class action, and there has to be substantial evidence in the complaint and in the pleadings to support the claim. We don't believe that there's substantial evidence in this case. Let's take numerosity, for example. Numerosity in the complaint, even if confessed, says that quote, on information and belief, the class is so numerous that joinder of all members is impractical. That's the broad, conclusory statement unsupported by substantial evidence.
Okay, you're saying the correct statement was made, but there's no evidence in the record to support it.
Exactly. And the evidence that goes to support numerosity, for example, later on, is evidence of a press release from the West Virginia Attorney General, unverified, no affidavit to substantiate that. Nielsen television rating showing 1.1 million households in the Indianapolis area. Matters that are not evidence, matters that don't affect and don't determine class action certification. This class action claim, by the way, is a claim for damages under contract. He has asked in the pleading for a contract class action, but the court, but he's asking for it on unjust enrichment and deceptive advertising claims. These are equitable remedies. You can't have an unjust enrichment case
based on a contract.
You just can't, yeah, as a matter of law.
What about, didn't I read somewhere in all of this voluminous documentation that there was a class action in certification in South Carolina?
Apparently there was.
And that this court used the same, granted class action certification here in Indiana on the same grounds as the South Carolina court had. Is there anything like that in the record?
There is something, well, when you say in the record, there's, yeah, something in the formal record to the court. There's nothing in the formal record that's presented as evidence that the court could properly consider as an evidentiary basis to support any of the claims for class certification. When you go down the list and look at numerosity, the other claims that we have alleged, the commonality, the predominance claims, it is impossible to show predominance in all of these contract claims. Let me show you. It's a blown up copy of the first page of the contract signed by Mr. Sandlin. It shows a lot of possibilities for clients to come in and retain the services of J.K. Harris for different kinds of tax matters. In fact, the tax matter that he's filed suit on is one of several tax matters that he asked J.K. Harris to assist with. The ability of a single member of a class action to adequately represent everybody in who has dealt with J.K. Harris in this matter is an improbability. The fact is that an analysis of a claimant's claim is going to have to take into account the monies paid, the tax circumstances of that particular client, the ability of the client to pay. Those are all uniquely individual situations.
If it's based on the contract.
Based on contract, absolutely. And this court, not this court, but Judge Najem in your concurrence in the Gresh case, found that these are not circumstances that are supportive of class action certification. So even though there was a default, the burden still is on a plaintiff to establish and for the court to make findings to determine that class action certification is appropriate.
Okay, now let me ask you this. We have something of a conundrum here. Since your client was not present when this determination was made, you're saying then that the court needs to go forward and make this determination on the evidence presented, and that the same rules, that default rules that might apply to the underlying claim do not apply in the case of class action certification.
Correct. In other words, it'll apply as to the complaint, but in this case, the complaint is very, very general and doesn't have in it specific evidence that constitutes substantial evidence to support a class action claim. The evidence that's supported.
You can imagine a situation where the complaint would be specifically pleaded enough, even if there was a default, that a class action could be sustained.
Yes.
But not in this case.
But not in this case.
Can we go back to the summons in this whole question of Rule 5? I haven't seen the summons in this case, but I assume it's a standard pre-printed summons.
Yes.
That the general summons says that should you fail to appear, answer, or otherwise plead within so many days, depending upon the manner of service, a default judgment may be entered against you for the relief requested.
Yes.
Okay.
Something
to that effect.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So going back to your original argument about the effect of this document being attached, the contract being attached with the arbitration provision, doesn't that tell the defaulting party, the party who fails to appear, respond to the summons that if you don't appear and defend in this case, you run the risk that the relief requested by the plaintiff will be granted?
I think so, yes.
Okay. This
is a case where service was on a resident agent. Mm-hmm. This is an out-of-state corporation. I'm out of time. I'll come back.
That's okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
How are you?
Very good. Very good. My name is Don Kite. As the court's indicated, I'm from the law firm of Dean Webster, Wright, and Kite. And just to introduce folks who are with us today, to my direct left, the court's right, is Chad Wirtz. We're going to be dividing our time in the argument in this case, as we indicated in the sheet that we turned in. I'll be addressing the first two issues, and Mr. Wirtz, the second, or the class action issue. And then Mr. Wirtz is at the Wirtz Law Firm. And then seated to his left is Zachary Rosenbarger, also from the Wirtz Law Firm. Directly behind me in the cable knit sweater, I don't know how to describe sweaters, but is Mr. Sandlin, so he's with us as well today. I do want to thank the court for the opportunity to be here, and I've told the court that we're dividing our argument. At the end of the day, we urge the court to affirm Judge Carroll's order with respect to the various motions filed by Mr. Miller in this case. I'm going to skip any statement of the facts because this is a bench obviously has some questions and just go right to my argument. But I want to emphasize a couple of procedural facts here. First of all, it's important to note, as the trial court did and as Mr. Miller has conceded in his brief, not only that J.K. Harris was properly served with the class action complaint in this case, but also, as Mr. Miller admits in his reply brief, and that's page 4 of his reply brief, that he's not challenging at this point the service of any of the pleadings that were filed by Mr. Sandlin after the class action complaint was filed and served. So the only issue, from Mr. Miller's perspective, is what was the fate or the status of the orders that the trial court issued? And were those orders, and specifically orders of four hearings, mailed out?
That's the last part of 5A, I think. Can I see that?
Yeah.
Excuse me. I just want to make sure I understand this. You're saying that all that's being challenged then is the provision under 5A, which says every written notice, appearance, demand, offer of judgment, designation of record, or similar paper. Is that it?
Yes, that's correct, Judge. That's all at this point that Mr. Miller appears to be challenging.
There's also under one, every order required by its terms to be served, assuming, okay.
Right.
That's because, and let me make sure I understand this, there was that subsequent pleadings, I'll call them generically, that were filed as post-complaint, that there was, in fact, a certificate of service to the defendant at what, its corporate address?
Well, at the corporate address, and on various occasions through the proceedings, Judge Carroll ordered or instructed or requested that Mr. Wirtz also serve the highest officer found at the Indianapolis address.
That's 96th Street, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And then also to serve them, and I always get this wrong, I apologize if I...
In South Carolina?
Yes, the Goose Creek, I think it's the address or the town, but they're headquarters, and they moved. It used to be Charleston.
Also, while we're on this subject, either now or later in your oral argument, please address what appears to be, there were some statements made that Mr. Wirtz had numerous contacts with officers, I'll say, of the defendant over a period of time before default judgment was entered. Does the record show that?
It does, Your Honor. Well, here's what the record shows. Mr. Miller, Mr. Wirtz, and Judge Carroll, during various hearings, it would only be the February 22nd of 2010 hearing, all addressed the fact that there had been various communications, letters, phone calls, and such. As Mr. Miller argues, and he's right about this, there wasn't discussion during those hearings, or what I'd call in-depth discussion, about what the content was of those communications.
But there were contacts.
There were contacts, okay. And the communications were about this lawsuit.
The reason I ask that is, going back to what Judge Baker had said at the very outset of this hearing, is that courts don't like default judgments.
Yes.
And particularly when the attorney for the plaintiff shows up on the first available day and moves for a default judgment. But here there appears to have been a period of some 4 months between the filing of the complaint and the entry of default judgment. Is that about right?
That's about right. Yeah. I think it was just a bit longer than that.
Okay.
I will tell the court, and I recognize, as does Mr. Wirtz, that you know there are two presumptions or areas that are significant for courts. One is that where courts don't like default judgments, and the other is that courts love or like, I guess it's on a scale, arbitration provisions. We know that. But in this case, the communications that were had with Mr. Wirtz were substantial. Once Mr. Miller filed his initial brief, I thought, and Mr. Wirtz thought, that what we should do is to send to Mr. Miller what his client, his out-of-state client, may not be giving him. So we sent him a bundle of emailed communications, for example, communication that Mr. Wirtz had with the Vice President of Legal Affairs for J.K. Harris.
Was she one of the parties served? Heidi, someone?
Heidi Benton, yes, yes, Your Honor. And he had a very specific communication, if I could.
It's right there.
He had a very specific communication. We sent this to Mr. Miller. Now, I will acknowledge what Mr. Miller is going to tell you in his rebuttal, which is that this is not in the record.
Well, if it's not in the record, we really don't have time to hear it. The point is that there is some evidence, or was it in the nature of argument, that there was communication?
It was evidence. At some of the hearings that occurred before Mr. Miller appeared, the court still took a record and heard from Mr. Wirtz, for example, and there was evidence of communication.
Heard from Mr. Wirtz as an officer of the court, not as a witness, not as a fact witness.
Well, that's correct, but he also talked about what he had done, so I think that...
Okay. Thank you for answering my questions along that line.
Absolutely. Thank you, Judge. So I think we focused in on the fact that the issue is really sharpened by Mr. Miller to just what happened with these four hearings. And, of course, we did cite a case in our brief that talked about exactly what the court was asking Mr. Miller about, which is after there is service, proper service of a complaint, if the defendant chooses not to answer, that's it. It's essentially over. We cited that case that there is not an ongoing obligation for the court to continue to serve or to make sure that there's service. But in this case, that happened. And even the orders that Mr. Miller has been complaining were not served on J.K. Harris, even if you assume that's the case, he is not contesting the fact that J.K. Harris knew from the very title of the complaint that class action relief was being sought, that there was detail to the complaint, and that each of these motions that asked for hearings on class notice, on every aspect of this case.
Now, what you're saying, the record would support the conclusion that even though the defendant had failed to appear, answer, or otherwise plead, that the defendant was still kept in the loop, so to speak, that this case was ongoing and that these things were going to be happening and had been scheduled and that this kind of relief had been requested and so forth.
Absolutely. Neither Mr. Wirtz nor myself specialize in trying to obtain default judgments. Mr. Wirtz hoped from the very beginning of this case, I can tell you we've had this discussion, that he was going to find a defendant who was actually going to engage, was actually going to pay attention. It's more of a surprise. And the thing that's been surprising to us, of course, and I'm going to talk about this hopefully because it'll be of interest to the court, is that, and I do primarily defense work, and what happens oftentimes, as the court I'm sure is well aware, you get phone calls from clients who unfortunately have defaulted. And the first question that a defense attorney asks, or that we're trained to ask, is, tell me your story. Tell me what happened. Did the custodian, who ordinarily doesn't pick up complaints, put them somewhere?
And we know all those permutations, and there's a lot of case law on it. Fortunately or unfortunately, every practicing lawyer takes his client where he finds him.
Right.
In other words, as I understand it, Mr. Miller got a phone call on a Friday, I think that it says, and then he then started to represent, and he's responsible for what happened going forward, but everything that had transpired before Mr. Miller was retained, you know, he's got to deal with that because that's the way it happened before he was counsel.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I'm not blaming Mr. Miller. My point is that the reason, of course, that you asked the question, and I've practiced law probably the least amount of time than most of the people that are in this room, but the reason you asked the question is so you can have something informative to say when you address the trial court. And in this case, what happened was, I understand Mr. Miller's argument about excusable neglect, and he's right. In every pleading, not he's right about his argument, he's right, that was his argument. In every pleading that he filed and in his brief, what he argued was excusable neglect because there was a failure of service. There was a lack of notice. But during the hearing of February the 22nd, 2010, and in the motions that he filed, there was absolutely no argument made. And more importantly, there was absolutely no evidence offered. Mr. Miller knows he has more experience, again, than I do. And I've not been a sitting trial judge in this state. He has more experience. He knows that he should have had an affidavit or certainly, even if his client doesn't know that, there should have been some evidence that they weren't served, that they didn't have notice. And you'll never hear Mr. Miller say that they didn't have actual notice.
Well, I think there's a negative inference here, is that if such an affidavit was available, it would have been obtained.
I agree with
if that. If it could have been. Can you move on to the arbitration argument? Mr. Miller makes an interesting argument that the court basically adopted the contract, but the entry of judgment should have taken the arbitration provisions into account rather than simply granting the relief prayed for. I think that's a fair summary of what Mr. Miller said.
Right. There are a couple things. We cited cases in our brief which made it very clear. I think they were all federal cases from the Southern District of Indiana, but that talked about the fact that a plaintiff has no obligation to plead its way out of whatever affirmative defenses may be asserted against it. If a defendant chooses to actually defend the lawsuit.
Would an 8C defense be the proper defense? In other words, if Mr. Miller had been retained at the outset, would he come in and would an 8 to say that this court lacks jurisdiction over this case because this belongs in arbitration?
I think that's correct.
Okay.
I think certainly that was the most careful way to do it, to assert it that way, and then if it ended up being a summary judgment, non-affirmative defense argument, then he would make that as well, but then he covers the bases. And unfortunately, we don't have any of that. In this case, we think that, and we're asserting, and we've argued, that the arbitration argument, the argument that the trial court was divested of jurisdiction by virtue of the arbitration clause, was waived. And we think it was waived because there was a case, this court's well aware of it, obviously, but there was a case decided by this court, the TAMCO case, several years ago, which specifically held that an arbitration could be waived not only by virtue of affirmative actions taken by a party, the typical cases.
By an omission.
Yes, they come in and the other party argues about it, but also by omissions. And the significant part about that, unfortunately, that since that case, that the omission route it has not really been fleshed out by the Indiana courts.
Right, that tells me about arbitration, but it doesn't tell me about class actions.
We think the argument is exactly the same, Your Honor, that it can be waived by virtue of the default judgment.
But isn't there still a burden of proof? In other words, doesn't the plaintiff who's seeking class action certification have to dot his I's and cross his T's, or does the trial court simply accept the allegations and check off the three fundamental requirements and go down the road? I mean, what quantum of evidence is required even in a default setting?
Well, we certainly think we agree, and Mr. Wirtz is going to address specifically for you exactly what the evidence was.
That's right. That's right. We're sorry. That's Mr. Wirtz's part.
I walked on your argument by asking you a question that
belongs to Mr. Wirtz.
Oh, no, and I realize I have a responsibility for that since I'm standing in front of you. I was just going to tell you that he'll address it even more specifically.
We even have that much patience.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. But there are three cases I do want to bring to the court's attention because they're, although not Indiana cases, there are cases that have helped to flesh out this omission route, the omission way of getting there, if you will. One is the Conseco Finance Servicing Corporation versus Hill case, decided by the Georgia Court of Appeals in 2001, 556 Southeast 2nd, 468 at 474, which held that the failure to timely answer waives this very arbitration.
That's in your, that case is in your brief, though, right?
I don't know if it is in our brief. I think there, these
don't
are.
I believe so.
No?
Perhaps it is. Maybe the other two are not.
I saw a Conseco in there. Go ahead.
I apologize, Your Honor. But one case that is not, and it's a California, it's an unpublished California Court of Appeals case that I wanted to bring to the court's attention, called AYRE, A-Y-R-E, versus Bengal, like the Tiger, Industries, 2008 Westlaw, 4099022, September 1st, 2008. The California Court of Appeals specifically held, and they acknowledged the trial court was right in the Court of Appeals judgment, that many cases are filed which contain arbitration provisions where parties are proceeding and they're assuming that the defendant is going to raise how the arbitration provision divests the court of jurisdiction. Many cases are filed in that instance and actually, you know, go to judgment, for example. But specifically, the court said that a party cannot simply ignore an arbitration provision and then wait until after a default to assert it and act as though it had asserted it.
We've got cases in Indiana that say that, don't we?
Right. I just thought this was even more specific. No.
To cite a California unsightable opinion when you have Indiana cases that say the same thing, it seems to me that you're working too hard.
The reason I did it, Your Honor, is because the reason I cite that case is because I don't think that the Indiana cases are as specific.
Did we have one involving Chrysler Corporation or something?
On the omission.
That had a arbitration provision in, you know, like a repair contract or something, and they didn't raise it, or they got defaulted. step to the pay window.
Well, I'd certainly rely upon that case as well. Okay. I can cite it later. But the third case, and I apologize, it is another case from out of state, but there's a case from Arkansas, the Supreme Court, a case of first impression, where the court said that, as a matter of first impression, the timely filing of an answer is what's required in order to challenge an to be able to
do it by a motion to dismiss, challenging the jurisdiction over this case. You could do it by an affirmative defense.
Right.
There's a lot of ways to do it.
But you're saying, he's saying, though, that the fair to answer basically slams the door.
You've got to do something.
That's exactly right.
What's the citation on the Arkansas case?
It's 61 Southwest 3rd, 172, Your Honor, at page 174, 2001 case. It's interesting, and I never thought I'd cite an oral argument a New York trial court decision, but there's a great, the court relies in part or finds persuasive a New York trial court, and the court in that case specifically said, and I'll quote, just take me about 10 seconds, although arbitration clauses are generally enforced, they cannot be used to bypass the statutory provisions requiring that pleadings be answered or to thwart a proper motion for summary judgment. The defendant effectively waived its right to enforce the arbitration clause when it failed to answer or appear in response to the summons and complaint.
Well, isn't that the same rule that would apply and when any time you have just a statute of limitations, for example? You may have a statute of limitations defense, and it may be perfectly sound, but if you fail to appear and assert it, you lose it.
That's right.
It's the same principle. Was that in the New York supplement? Did they put trial court opinions in the New York sup?
It was. It's not the New York sup site that I'm familiar with. It's
okay.
N period, Y period, S period, and that's okay. 717 York. I don't know what that is. S second, okay. 860 at page 863.
Would this be a good opportunity for us to hear from Mr. Wirtz with regard to Trial Rule 23 issues?
Thank you, Your Honor, very much. And just so the court knows, as long as you can still see the lights, I'm going to turn this so Mr. Wirtz can see the time.
That's fine.
Mr. Wirtz, you may be heard.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I can see that you're well prepared for me now on the class certification issue. You made that quite clear.
The ball is on the tee.
Indeed. Coming into this, there was a great deal of head scratching. Yeah, we had a class action matter that we were trying to bring to the table, and then we had default and nationwide company we're looking at here. And I thought, my Lord, I wasted my education, didn't really learn anything. What's going to happen? Well, that being said, I would like to first explain to you our argument and position on the effect that the default a proper default has on the class certification, and then I'll address my intent is to then address any concerns you may have on the process of numerosity and going to the class cert. Now, Trial Rule 23C1 provides that a party may waive a hearing on maintainability of class certification. Okay, and then this court in its finding in Core Funding Group laid out that a default precludes review of the class certification, explaining that a class action defendant should not be able to prevent a class action from moving forward by its non-participation.
Well, so your argument is by them failing to appear that they that alone will not thwart class action certification.
That is correct.
But that's not the same thing as saying that you're entitled to it just because you asked for it.
Correct.
Okay.
We're not moving on.
Let me ask though, Mr. Wirtz, are you indicating to us that we cannot go behind the trial court's order, even if we're a little queasy about conclusory statements? In other words, probably what troubles me the most is that we have a certification based on assertions that just track the requirements. Don't cite facts, much to the exhibit that Mr. Miller has shown us today, that there are a lot of different ways that people come to J.K. Harris, and they're not all the same. How do we get a class out of such disparate potential people, and why should we base our decision upon simple conclusory statements?
Sure.
If I can, so you can address it all in one time. What I see here is the default mechanisms have been designed as an efficiency. And if Smith and Jones have a fight, let them do it. But all of a sudden now we have a court involved in resolving disputes for people that even that don't even know that they're at the bar. So help me with that part as you answer his question. Thanks.
Okay. Now, there were several questions and sub-questions in there, so you may have to redirect me at some point.
Certainly.
Okay. Several ways of handling that, but I would clearly I see and understand the concerns that you have, but you know, the first thing that I would say, I would have to ask you to step back for a moment and understand that in the complaint, that it wasn't just a conclusory statement in there, let me back up. Before there was ever even a default, there had been a motion for class certification, and along with that motion was attached the Nielsen ratings that Mr. Miller spoke of. In addition, the South Carolina case, in which it established a class number of over 50,000 class members using the definition.
Is that a case of record? Is that a cited case, or is this just information that you happen to know?
It's a class action settlement, actually.
I mean, is there something in the public record, some authority we could look to concerning the South Carolina?
The website is, there is, and I just don't have, can I?
Maybe while you continue to answer the questions, co-counsel might find that for us.
Very good. All right. And so part of that, along with the motion for class certification, again, we had there was information regarding another class action involving again offers and compromise, which is the same common issue here, including 18 attorneys general. But then the one in South Carolina is the one that we focused on the most because we had more information on it. That's where we gained our class definition that we included. We cited it as well. And interestingly, there, what had taken place is the court appointed a company to carry out the notification process for the claims, or class members, I'm sorry. That company had the luxury of using a class list with class information provided to it by J.K. Harris, which is from which they identified 51,000 class members, and something in excess of 51,000.
In other words, there was some kind of discovery which produced this document, which became the template for the company to pursue, identify and pursue the class.
That is correct, Your Honor. That information was before the court when my application for default was filed. But let me back you up even one more time. So we had that complaint that was filed with that definition, and in it also indicating that the court where it was filed also was the proper jurisdiction for it to be. Then we filed the motion for class certification. In that, we laid out what we could put together not having participation. Then we did have some communication. That's when the communications began quite heavily between my office and J.K. Harris.
But are these communications part of the record that we have before us?
They are not, Your Honor.
We're not allowed to consider that.
So I understand.
You need to help us protect ourselves from... talk about stuff we don't.
Let me cut to the chase, if I may. You rely heavily on the Core case.
That's correct.
Is that what you consider to be precedent, directly on point?
Well, in the Core case, they laid out in their complaint, I'm quite well aware that there are at least 40 members. In addition to saying there are numerous and unknown, they laid out that at least 40 members. Now, I would say that, yes, but the only way that we could come up with that would be...
You needed help from the defendant.
We needed help from the defendant.
And you didn't get it.
Which is the reason why we then went and brought to the court, because we know none of the items that I've mentioned to you on their own were going to establish that we had a class. But we had to use with other cases as well, to include CSX Transportation. V. Clark.
Did you use those, the communications of which you speak, did you report those to the court in order to establish some of the requirements of Trial Rule 23?
Whenever, walk a fine line here.
I thought so. That's why I asked the question.
Without crossing that line.
Is there a record of what you said to Judge Carroll that has been provided?
November 2nd was the date that we had, were to have a hearing on class certification. On that date, I appeared before Judge Carroll, who wanted to know where J.K. Harris was, which was a question I parroted because I had no idea either. At which time, it's not on the record. I do not know that the court at that time, I know that it did not go on the record because Judge Carroll, I think you can hear, you can imagine what Judge Carroll was saying was, hey, you know, they're not here. I'm sure you're not going to plead their affirmative defenses and make, build their defense for them. So it was not on the record outside of that.
What do you consider to be, in a default setting, your burden? I think to use one of Judge Baker's favorite terms is that the possible class action defendant cannot rope-a-dope and not participate and basically frustrate the class certification just by not participating. But what quantum of evidence do you believe or argue is required in order to check off the requirements for class action certification when the defendant, who may have most of the information you need, is not there?
After we got, I got into this with Judge Carroll in a later hearing when Judge Carroll was, what in my mind was continuing to make sure that class certification should make, remain in place.
And was that hearing on the record?
That was on the record.
And what was the date of that hearing?
I believe those were both, because I was questioned in both hearings, one in November, the end of November, and I'm wanting to say it was November 25th or 8th, and then December 28th.
And you say there was at least a colloquy between you and the judge on the class action certification?
That was after the order had been entered, am I correct?
That's correct. Oh, it was going to be December 28th, and then it was January 25th, so I apologize.
But each of those hearings were post-order certifying class.
Of course. Now, my understanding of that throughout the...
Excuse me. Between the oral arguments, I inadvertently picked up my cell phone, and I apologize to the court and to the parties.
No problem.
Go ahead, sir.
It's my understanding that there is also, at least in part, due to the fact that we know that a class certification can be decertified, right? So the trial court has an obligation for ongoing making certain that there is a class that's certified. As you go through, as you know, there will be additional discovery and there will be different hearings, and you'll winnow it down and so that you have a very clear class, excluding members that shouldn't have normally been in there for one reason or another, folks opting out. However, without participation, I only think, what we're going to do? We're just not going to, okay, well, we got our default. Here we are. We got a class. Do we have a class? We can't do anything until they decide to participate. So we look to a court, and if you ask me for a site.
This is the South Carolina case we're talking about?
This is. It's in the appellant's appendix, 61, page 61. So I spoke to Judge Carroll about this and doing it in a way that, you know, you normally have a class list, you provide the notice, and folks either remain in or they'll opt out. Well, we weren't having any participation. So one of the solutions that I proposed was that we have the opt-in, which led to the padlocking of the doors. The hope was that we were going to be able to seize enough funds that we could do enough advertising to cover the state of Indiana to get folks to.
And it was this closure. Now, was that just at the Indianapolis location? There are four or five locations in the state.
Six locations. Stretching from Fort Wayne to Evansville.
And was this the only location that was padlocked?
Six locations were closed.
And that's the event that precipitated the appearance of Mr. Miller in this case?
An hour and a half after the doors were locked, I've got my first phone call since October.
Where can we look to see in the most, where can we find the evidence in the record that was before the trial judge when the trial judge certified the class? Where is that going to be found?
Okay. The motion for class certification had the Nielsen information that's been mentioned. It had the information regarding both of the class action information found on page 61 of the appellant's appendix. But the motion for class certification will be found in the appellate's appendix beginning on page 50 to 98.
My question, though, is where's the evidence? I mean, a motion in itself is not evidence. Is there anything in addition to the text of the motion that would be before the trial court going
did
to the
initially file or
going to the ultimate determination that there the class should be certified?
That's going only that which is in the complaint that's been confessed at that point.
So we have the complaint, and then we have the subsequent motion. And does that motion, does that show a certificate of service on the defendant?
Of the motion, yes.
Okay.
If I understand your argument correctly, Mr. Wirtz, under core funding, all you really needed was a complaint upon which default had been entered.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That actually raised Trial Rule 23 class certification.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So from your standpoint, defaults entered on a complaint that said, and oh, by the way, Judge, this should be a class action. That's enough. We don't need to and shouldn't look behind that.
How it's going to be regulated and how whether it's regulated correctly is not for us today.
That's correct.
That's Judge Carroll's worry
after
the interlocutory hearing.
That's correct, and I'm sorry for interrupting. In the order certifying, he retained jurisdiction through Trial Rule 23D to do just that.
Okay. Is there any case that you have found that, other than those that might have been cited by Judge May in her opinion, since CORE was decided in 03, and the Supreme Court even denied transfer the same year, they were really timely that year. And so, do you know of any other case that addresses the certification of a class when there has been a default in Indiana or anyplace else?
I do not, Your Honor. Okay.
It's not your responsibility to bid against yourself. Thank you. Anything else on this issue? I gather that you got relegated class.
That's correct.
And your co-counsel is going to try to carry the rest of the ball. Is that right?
That's correct.
We're out of time. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew that I wasn't cutting him off just because I thought he was done, because he is done, definitionally.
I did want to continue answering your questions, however.
Well,
I didn't think it was appropriate for me to cut you off.
That's all right. Other people do.
Yeah.
Makes me feel at home. Go ahead, sir.
I wouldn't dare, Your Honor.
Hey, Mr. Miller, you got to get us past CORE.
Yes.
Help us get past CORE.
CORE funding.
Well, let's see. To distinguish CORE, actually, there's a statement in CORE that said CORE does not address in its brief the effect of the default judgment. And that's the key, the effect of the default judgment on class certification. CORE argued in its reply brief that the default judgment didn't preclude appellate review of the class certification it raises on appeal. We think we have the right to at least demand that, and you have the right to demand, the trial court should have substantial evidence to support class action certification. This is a special remedy. We are asking the trial court in these situations to take on the responsibility for protecting, purportedly protecting, other persons' interests. Young's complaint included allegations that were justified class action certification under Trial Rule 23, and there was a lengthy hearing. There was evidence presented in CORE so that the court had facts from which it could render a decision.
So that is your distinction, is that we had more in CORE. Young did more in his complaint against CORE funding than Sandlin did in its complaint against Harris.
I would go further than that. I say Young did, Sandlin didn't. Young presented evidence, let alone substantial evidence. The court found it to be substantial evidence. In this case, there's no evidence. There are bald allegations of generalizations under Trial Rule 23, no evidence to support it. No affidavits, no admissible evidence, none at all. Now, I'd like to take a few moments, since I only have about 3 minutes left, and tell you what I think about Trial Rule 60B8, which is a significant part of what I think this court should consider in this particular case. We know, as Judge Baker has eloquently stated today, that default judgments are not favored under the law. The rules allow for relief to be granted in certain circumstances. And Trial Rule 60B8 is sort of a, I don't want to say potpourri, but perhaps it's just a general catch-all for equity. And we are arguing in this case under 60B8 equity. One, the terms of the contract that were accepted call for binding arbitration. It calls for the plaintiff certainly agreed not to participate in class action in any way, shape, or form. It limited damages to the amount contained under the contract. Service issues. Now, while the original service was definitely performed on the agent, we have no idea, and I have no idea, what was going through J.K. Harris's mind in that four-month period of time. I can tell you that I get a hint from the Appellee's brief when it says in two different places that the case was first filed in the Center Township Small Claims Court. I have no idea what that was all about. So I can presume service was made on that complaint to J.K. Harris as well, but it's a presumption. Again, we have no court service of the orders for October 4th, no service of the order of the October 2nd motion for class certification. No hearing was conducted on that issue. No order sent on the motion for production of class list November 12th. No motion or no order sent on the motion to produce class notice of November 25th, the amended class notice, the motion for award of damages on December 28th, and rule to show cause for January 25th. All of these, by the way, the court made mention that when the order itself calls for service, the court's obligated to serve it. If you'll notice on all of those orders, there's a CC to the parties, but it's not part of the CCS. So the court had on it, on its orders, carbon copies. No one uses carbons anymore, but that order was duly noted to be sent out, and it wasn't, according to the CCS. We have shown that there's a meritorious defense by the terms of the contract. Even though statute of limitations issue has not been addressed by this court, it is on its face fairly clear that there's an issue there, an issue to be resolved by the trial court. Motions were filed as soon as counsel was notified of the problem in this case, and that was when J.K. Harris's stores were closed. We have additionally listed more than 20 reasons in our reply brief as to why equity demands that the motion for default be set aside and we be allowed to answer the complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Thank you to counsel for your oral and specifically your written arguments that, with which you have graced us. We caution you and the audience not to take anything from the questions that we have asked. We do so in order to stimulate our discussion. As is the want of the Indiana Court of Appeals, we will give you a timely response in writing. Thank you.
Thank you.